Whitaker, you will notice that I don't use an intro. I'm used to ham radio. I'm used to just talking into a mic like I'm doing now. First, I did say in the British group that I was going to talk about somewhat about Britain. It reminds me of my father was over in Britain back in the 50s in London. And criticism of America was not entirely new back then either. An Englishman walked up to my father, or Britain, I should say. I don't know if he's English or not. And he said, "You're from the United States, aren't you?" And my father said, "Yes, I'm from the United States." And the fellow said, "I know a lot of bad things about America." And my father said, "I know more things bad about America than you do." And we here know a great deal that's wrong with our country. I'm sure we're also very familiar with a lot of good things about our countries. I want to get into the reason, to the title of the show, which I will repeat a number of times. One of the nice things about not having an intro is that you can introduce it yourself pretty well the way you want to. Once again, back to the United Kingdom, there's an organization there called Flat Earth Society. It is dedicated to the proposition that despite all these conspiracy theories about the Earth being round, it's actually flat. I think they have a lot of fun, but they have been around for an awfully long time. So back in the 60s, the American ambassador had gotten photos. The NASA had just sent the first American orbital satellite around and taken pictures of the Earth. So just for fun, the American ambassador decided he'd invite the head of the Flat Earth Society over and tell him and show him these pictures of the round Earth. Well, this was an unflappable Englishman, and he was glad to accept the invitation. He came over, and he looked at the photos, and the American ambassador said, "What do you think?" And the gentleman said, "It is amazing how, to the untrained eye, the Earth looks round." And I have decided that this show should be called The Untrained Eye. I just look at the world the way the world is. I did have an education. It was supposed to train my eye to miss the points that are obvious, but it didn't take. Give you a good idea of what a trained eye looks like. Let's go back to the British elections that took place on May the 5th. Now, when I was in Britain in 59, last time I actually looked at an election over there in detail, they had 630 seats in the House of Commons total. And each of these seats, of course, has a district of its own. It has politics of its own. And the trained eye will be looking to see exactly how many people voted for Tony Blair, and how many people voted conservative, and how many voted the other party. I think Liberal Democrats or but what if your eye is not trained, what you noticed was that the British didn't vote. Now, Europeans are compulsive voters. After every election over the last 50 years, I can testify that at the end of every election, the commentators, media commentators, would get that sour look on their face and say, Americans don't vote. 50% don't register. 50% of the ones who register don't vote. And we're not good citizens. Now, in France, 90% or more of the people show up and so forth and so on. I've been hearing this for about 50 years. But the Europeans always showed up at the polls. It was sort of a duty. When a major portion of a European country does not show up at the polls, that is very important. This time, nationwide, I think 36% of the British electorate did not show up. One gentleman was writing in Stormfront that in his district, where there is no white nationalist party, so what they got is a choice of the different parties that the Labour Party, or the Conservative Party, or the Liberal Democratic Party, none of which ever pays any attention to the elephant sitting right there in the living room. Less than 50% of his area voted. Now, in Europe, that is quite a phenomenon. I'm not sure anybody else has even talked about it. But Americans will not vote because there's no point in it. Europeans vote as a matter of duty. Somehow you're supposed to be doing other people a favor if you show up at the polls, whether you know anything about it or not. But this time, even the British were a little tired of the fact that, for example, you stand a better chance of what I say, elephant in the living room issues. For example, in Britain, out of every 7 robberies, 3 of them occur, burglaries, 3 of them occur when somebody just walks in while the family is still there and takes what they want, beats up the husband, breaks the wife, whatever they feel like. And the government has nothing to do about this except stronger laws on gun control. Lately they were talking about outlawing toy guns too. This will discourage the burglars. Of course, nobody had anything to say about the immigration issue, as all of the third world masses into Britain, and the Europeans have faithfully kept voting along every election for these parties, but lately, but this looks like something that not only will you lose your job, but your buddies are going to start referring you to a competent psychiatrist, and that goes down the line. We, on Capitol Hill, Fritz Hollings, just before he left office, made a statement that everybody on Capitol Hill knows that the Middle East policy has nothing to do with oil prices. It's a question of Israel. Now, publicly, you always have to say, No, it's all a matter of oil prices, and Israel has nothing to do with it, and so forth and so on. That's what you have to say. If you believe that, I repeat, if your boss on Capitol Hill, I don't care if you're a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican, if your boss finds out that you actually believe that, you will not only lose your job, because you're a fool, but a lot of your friends will start mentioning competent psychiatrists to you. So the trained eye is what we call the educated eye. It is inculcated on the students on the campus, exactly how they talk about things, how they are to look at things. This reminds me of the ham radio operator days. We would build, I got my license about in the 50s, and we would have to build our own little sacks. And that meant you had a whole lot of, little soldering to do for your resistors and all these other things. The whole thing, you put it together from scratch. And if one of those 100-something soldering connections you had made was loose, then the whole machine did not work. So you spent a good deal of your time crawling up and turning it off first, unless you wanted a shock, and then checking it out. And so none of this is probably as hard on me as it is at the headquarters. But I was talking about doublethink. If I run back to what I was talking about before, I did say the name of the program is The Untrained Eye. And the reason for this was the Flat Earth Society head, when he was shown the NASA photographs of how the world was round, he said, "It is amazing how, to the untrained eye, the world looks round." And I think that's a pretty good description of the way we think today. We all have trained eyes. We all know what we're supposed to say. We all know it isn't true. And so where I was getting with this was, we are the only thing wrong with what I'm doing here, the only thing radical about what I'm doing here, is that I'm saying what all of us already know. I've gotten around to the fact that if a country is brown-skinned, and that's all you know about it, you're going to come to certain conclusions about that country. Now, it's not their fault or whatever, this, that, and the other. See, now I'm getting a strained eye a bit. The simple fact of the matter is, brown countries are poor. They're not the sort of place that a child should be born. And white countries do the inventing. I'm sitting here talking on a machine invented by whites. We all know that. And the reason, but you're not allowed to say this out loud. Trouble is, we are betting the history, or rather the whole future of the human race, on the idea that this skin color thing is an accident. I don't think that a decent person is going to do that. And I will not do it. I don't believe when you say, "Well, color of the skin makes no difference." I simply say, I don't believe you. Not only the future, there's also, of course, the obvious fact that I am white. I was just telling about Hispanics tend to vote for undocumented workers who are named Sanchez and who have, from their point of view, as much right to be in America as Smiths and Jones and Whitakers. But they look at their American citizenship, that is to say, the majority of Hispanic voters vote as if, no matter what many dissident Hispanics or people with Hispanic names who've been here for hundreds of years will be a whole different category. But generally speaking, if you're on Capitol Hill and you make your living at this game, you assume that that the loyalty of a Hispanic voter is not to these documents that say United States of America on them that some bureaucrat hands out. It is to Hispanics. Now that's what real politics is based on. That's what everybody says when they say that the Republicans cut their throat when they try to deny benefits to the Hispanics. That's what they said. Now, when I say it in English, I could probably be prosecuted under the hate laws of 50 or 60 countries. So what we're doing is I am expressing mainline opinions. In fact, as I say, the sort of thing every politician has to believe it to know, and he's not going to hire anybody who doesn't know it. On the other hand, he's not going to hire anybody who says it. So, as I say, in the case of the British election, there's a huge wave of immigrants as the families become, as everybody is disarmed except criminals. Criminals are coming into their homes. When I went to Europe the first time back in the 1950s, it was almost comical how crime-free Britain was. It was known for it. And they still had the shillings and pence and farthing with a quarter of a penny. And we couldn't figure it out, so an American tourist would just stand there, hold the money out, and the British guy would just take whatever they needed to take. Never occurred to anybody that you could get cheated in Britain. Now, the people listening to me from Britain right now probably are either astonished or laughing. At Heathrow Airport, they regularly rob the suitcases. The crime rate, your chances of getting robbed in a small British town are better than your chances of getting robbed in, say, New York City. It's a total turnaround. Now, what exactly have the political parties been saying about this? Nothing. So even the British, the dutiful British, have begun to wonder why they go to the polls in the first place. There's a huge non-vote there. And what we're going to do with it, I'm not too sure. I'll tell you something else that somebody who does not have a trained eye will note. I keep hearing people, reading about people worrying about the huge Hispanic vote or the huge Asian vote or these different votes coming in and how politics are going to be turned upside down. Well, let me tell you something. There is not now, nor has there ever been, a multiracial democracy on the planet Earth. You seem to be assuming that there will be one when we become a multiracial country. We won't be. I'm not exactly sure what we will be. I'm not a prophet. But I can pretty well guarantee you that you're not going to have a democracy. And I'll tell you another logical reason why we won't have a democracy. It goes back to the basics of how you put a country together. There are two ways you can put a country together, or a people together. One is what I call, one is some sort of kinship, racial family affiliation. The other is what I call wordism. It can be a communist country, it can be an Islamic country, it can be a Christian country ruled by an emperor, like the Holy Roman Empire. There's all sorts of different nationalities jammed in together. But there is a fundamental problem with a country that you put together on the basis of wordism, on the basis of a book, on the basis of a belief. People say, well, America is really an idea. The problem is, when a country is an idea, what do you do about the people who don't subscribe to that idea? Well, you do what the multiculturalists are doing now. You suppress them. You've got to. Because your only unity comes from this book, the set of words you've got. Now, you can't have a holy book that is enforced all over a country and at the same time allow people freedom of expression. The two things don't go together. if you start allowing freedom of expression, your only basis of unity, which is that book or that idea or whatever it is, will collapse. So you can't have freedom, any freedom of expression. You can have a diversity of races, but as you have more and more diversity of races, the only thing that unites them is these American ideals, whatever the Supreme Court decides those are this week. And you can't allow people to dissent from those ideas. So the more diversity of peoples you get, the less diversity of ideas you have to have. So when we look at the future of America, a lot of people giving us these doomsday thing of, oh, it's all over. I've been listening to people give us these doomsday things since I was, I guess, 12 years old. But one lady told me that John Kennedy was Catholic, and if he was elected in 1960, we would never have another election in America again, so she was giving up politics. This is the Bible Belt. Now, the thing about these doomsday deadlines is that, first of all, they keep you from planning anything over the long run. I plan ideas. I see them sprout. And I sort of leave it up to other people to take the ideas and make something of them. What I'm doing is saying things that you're thinking. I don't think I've said a single thing that has surprised a single person who is listening to me. The only thing I do is take what you're thinking, I think it out in the simplest possible terms, and I say it. This is the untrained eye. So, let me check storm front here a minute, and then I'll talk about Pontiac, South Carolina, which is as everybody knows, the whole world is based on Pontiac, South Carolina, although many people are not aware of it. Let me check down here and see if anybody has been inspired. Nope, nobody's been inspired. Now, I was raised in Pontiac, South Carolina. Then I got a great deal of education. I wrote books. I got into power brokering. I got into professoring and all that stuff. And a lot of people don't quite understand why I think the way I do, because if you're a, quote, educated, unquote, person, you're supposed to think in a wordist way, an educated way. Now, from my point of view, that's not what an actual education does for you. An actual education is a tool. It doesn't change who you are. It is something you use for the purposes that your life is dedicated to. I'm still the same person I was then. I have a great deal of education. I like to tell people, I used to say I don't know nothing, but I got an education and found out that I do know nothing. In other words, it's a tool. It changes your grammar a bit. But if you were raised in a place like Pontiac where people are perfectly willing to admit there's a lot they don't know, and education doesn't ruin you, then when you become a 64-year-old man, the books behind you and all that stuff, you realize you have no trouble at all saying there's a great deal that I don't know. So when I talk about the future, all these dooms, remember, a doomsday prophet is a prophet. Now, if someone walks up to you and says, I predict that the world is going to be a utopia in 10 years, you say, this guy's a nut. But when somebody walks up to you and says, the world is doomed, people don't laugh at him, or at least not in our movement. But to predict doom is exactly the same as to predict utopia. You don't know what you're talking about. I personally don't know what this computer is going to look like in 10 years. I didn't know that I could sit here and talk to everybody, anybody on the planet Earth, all the way down to Antarctica, with my shoes off, sitting here in my living room, exchanging notes with James Kelso. And this is going to grow. And the media is already worried to death about this internet thing. Because the peasants are getting all sorts of information that professional journalists, with their trained eye, do not want these people to get hold of. I remember hearing somebody on Newswatch, public radio woman, one of the two official liberals. And she was saying, well, the problem with this internet is that too many people just get to listen to people who believe what they believe. And what you need is a mainline point of view. Well, from her point of view, what New York City and public radio says is a very varied diet of opinion, news, the whole bit. She has no idea. It's like Bloomberg said in his book on the media. It's not that these people sit around thinking, we have this plot to impose this agenda, this liberal agenda. It just never occurs to them that there is anything but a liberal agenda. This lady, I forget her name, but I'm sure that she is absolutely convinced that there is the mainline media and then there are a bunch of fringe lunatics out there. And that's all there are. And the fringe lunatics out there, outside of New York, are getting far too much space. It's a point of view. It's one point of view, and that is what she does not understand, that hers is a point of view. Now, let's see what I've got down here. By the way, speaking of this point of view, I can give you a pretty good example of it. When I was in Washington, I was at a cocktail party, again, and somebody from Ted Kennedy's staff, this is 1977, and Carter from Georgia, new president, was just being inaugurated. And somebody from Teddy Kennedy's staff wanted to talk to me, so I went over and he said, Bob, he said, you're a Southerner and you know your stuff. He said, tell me something. Is Jimmy Carter smart? Well, I sort of stood there for a minute. See, Jimmy Carter had the Southern accent, and one assumes that it couldn't be all that bright. There were several replies that could have come to my mind. I could have said, well, Jimmy Carter is not smart enough to get drunk one night and kill a girl in his car, like your boss is. Or I could have said, your boss has wanted desperately to be president for many, many years. James Earl Carter is now president. If he's not bright, then what are you? Well, I stood there for a few minutes trying to think of something to say, and finally I said, man, he's president. Of course he's smart. And I'm sure that the guy figured, you know, well, I asked Pontiac, South Carolina a question, and I got a Pontiac, South Carolina answer. But it does take a certain amount of talent to actually not like Gerry Ford to be elected, appointed president, of course you're harmless, but to get elected to the presidency. One of the things Jimmy Carter did to get elected that was considered really a filthy trick was during the Democratic primaries, you would see the Pennsylvania primary coming up and you would see every single candidate walking out of a synagogue in Philadelphia with a yarmulke on his head. They spent their time in Philadelphia, and then they'd take a quick trip over to Pittsburgh. Jimmy Carter did some arithmetic, and he discovered that almost the entire state of Pennsylvania is mountains. He discovered that half of the state of Pennsylvania, at least, lives in those mountains. He bought time on, what was the old, anyway, a country music show that has slipped my mind at the moment. You'd know it if I said it. It was a television show. And he hit on the radios and he started appealing to the kind of people he knew in Georgia. He started hitting those mountain voters that everybody ignored. And he swept it. He counted. He was a nuclear engineer, so I guess he learned to count. But this was a big deal in the political community. The trained eyes didn't notice it, as usual. And that is a big story in that election. It's like in the present election. And speaking of elections, now the story on the little parties in Europe, the little quote racist unquote parties that talk about immigration, the purpose of a small party has always been really to influence policy. Most of them have not taken power. But we had a prohibition party here before we had prohibition. We had an anti-slavery party here before we abolished slavery. Oh, the list is just about everything you've got as a change had a small party. Now, the Europeans keep the people, the trained eyes in Europe, look at the fact that these small parties in Europe are not taking over. They do not notice that European policy has, in fact, begun to turn against immigration. Not by your standards, not by my standards, but by their standards. And the reason it did that was because these small parties had an enormous political success in pulling these big parties in their direction. Now, this is real politics. This is real power. This is not whoever happens to be sitting in the White House. Man, the White House actually has very little power. This is policy. This is the real thing. And those small parties have had more effect on European, real European power politics than any other political parties in Europe. And I mean the big ones. Because it makes precious little difference which party is elected in any country in Europe. But every single vote that went to those little parties has had an effect. But again, the trained eye doesn't look at that. The trained eye doesn't look at real world reality politics. The trained eye is worried about whether Jimmy Carter or whether Clinton is good boy or bad boy or what the latest dirty is on so-and-so or who betrayed us and all that stuff. Meanwhile, the serious people are building ideas. Serious people like Jim Kelso and sitting back there putting together these programs, slowly getting this new media means off the air. Because remember, I remember when television was this way. I remember when it was all live and when all they had was a camera sitting there in a station. They'd try to find somebody to sing or somebody. We used to have old cowboy movies and somebody named Cactus Quaid in Columbia, South Carolina, Mackie Quaid. And he was called Cactus Quaid and they had some paper cactuses behind him and he had on a cowboy outfit, and he'd introduce these movies. I'd put on a vampire outfit, and he'd introduce the horror movies. And I'm sure that, and more than once, somebody, like I did just now, cut off his mic. And anybody today would say, of course, television is going to be a major power in the world. I think we kind of knew that, but it's always very hard to believe when you're sitting like I am, sitting here stepping on your microphone. But the people who get things done in the world, there more and more there's a division between people who do things and people who get credit for things. But the really powerful people are the people who are sitting there in Washington at 2 o'clock in the morning working on policy stuff, and people who are planning ideas and that sort of thing. By the time somebody gets to the prime ministry or something like that, he doesn't really have much influence on the outcome of affairs. Every now and then he can, but his whole time is to get elected, is spent getting elected. My congressman, I remember when a congressman hired me, he said, Bob, what I really need you to do, he said, I spend 3 days in the district, 4 days and up here, and he said, I have to keep up with everything. I have to remember everybody's name. I have to remember this, that, and the other, and what to say to who, and when the roll calls on, all that. He said, I don't have time to think. Bob, I want you to sit down and think for me. Now, there was a man, John Ashbrook. He had power, because if he couldn't do the thinking, then he'd find somebody who could. He'd hand me a book, and he'd say, what's in this book? And then I'd walk back in a day or two later and tell him, and in 5 or 10 minutes, no more than 15, what was in the book that he needed to know. And he probably ended up better with me taking all that clutter out than he would have sitting down and reading the book himself. Hiring staff, of course I'm a little prejudiced on this, but hiring staff is the essential job. When you get above a certain level, whether you work day or night, it doesn't really make that much difference. And when people are writing about what to do about this party or that party, it's a little frustrating, because in what we are doing is planting ideas, planting concepts, and above all, untraining our eyes and telling people what they see. Now, that kind of thing grows. People like jokes. I tell a joke about Henry Kissinger said about the Jews, and of course he left Nazi Germany. So he doesn't have any particular use for anti-Semitism, but as a professional diplomat, he said, a people that has been persecuted for 2,000 years is doing something wrong. And when it came to the whole question of Jews generally and the way they're treated, I like to tell the joke. I think I told this before on Dave's show, but I'm old, so I get to repeat things. So I came into town, little town out in the mountains, and walked into a country store there. He said to the country storekeeper, you know everybody in this town. He said, I'm thinking about moving here. How is it? How are the people here? Storekeeper thought about it a minute, and he said, well, how are the people in the last town you were in? Paul said, they were terrible. He said, they persecute you. I mean, I was as nice to them as I could be, and they just picked on me for no reason in the world. The old storekeeper said, well, you couldn't have been there long. How were the people in the town for that? I said, terrible, awful people. They would kick you. I mean, I was the nicest man you'd have ever met, and they treated me like a dog. The storekeeper stood there a minute, and he said, you know, people in this town are going to be about the same. In other words, the trained eye knows that a people that has been hated and kicked out of country after country after country after country really isn't doing anything wrong. Everybody else is crazy. They're not. The untrained eye worries a lot about somebody who's been kicked out of, who has been kicked out of the last 5 countries he was in. And that is a sort of common sense idea that spreads better than a huge volume or at least in my experience it does. And that's the sort of thing that I want to talk to you about when, if I get invited back next Saturday. You know, it's interesting talking about Southerners. One of my favorite jokes I've told many times is what Tennessee Ernie Ford said when Jimmy Carter got elected president. He said, "We're finally going to have a president who doesn't have an accent." And from a Southerner's point of view, we are, you know, pretty familiar, and people always talk home folks and all that stuff. It was interesting, there's some fella that who was on MASH, the program MASH, television program, but Ogden something. This guy was on MASH, and he played the Ivy League snob. He was from Alabama, and he played this Ivy League snob very well on MASH. And a New Yorker went down there with him one time, one of his New York associates. And he saw this guy and meet his family, hugged him. He said, "How y'all doing?" and all that stuff. The New Yorker got back to New York, and he said to his friends, he said, "Did you know that he was one of those?" And we Southerners are, to, say, New Yorkers, to people like that lady I was talking about on PBS, we are aliens. So, you know, the world has 2 sides to it. They don't understand us. That's not provincial. Because you're not supposed to understand Southerners. We'd like you to go to readbob.com. readbob.com. I would appreciate it deeply if you would read my book, which I'll talk about some more, because it's exactly, it again is, it's called Why Johnny Can't.